Welcome to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Dankman, in for Larry Mantle. Plenty of films on the docket this week. Three sequels in wide release to tell you about. And later this hour, we'll talk about the hit coming-of-age comedy, Eighth Grade, starring Elsie Fisher. The movie has gotten a lot of praise, but it's also raised a few eyebrows with its R rating that seems to have deterred some actual eighth graders from seeing the movie. We'll get into how the Motion Picture Association's rating system deals with adolescent content with the head of ratings at MPAA. But first, reviews. I'm joined this week by critics Tim Cogshell of Alt Film Guide and Cinegods.com, Peter Rayner of the Christian Science Monitor, and our animation guru Charles Solomon of Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you so much for being in studio.
Hi, Libby.
Hi.
Good to have you here. We are going to start with the most exciting release for me, at least. Let's start with Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again, a sequel to the 2008 film Mamma Mia. The musical comedy stars Amanda Seyfried, Meryl Streep, Lily James, and Christine Baranski, and of course features the music of ABBA. Ole Parker directed and wrote the screenplay. Peter, let's start with you.
Yes. Well, you're looking forward to this movie, are you not?
I am. Yes. You know, it looks like a lot of fun, Peter. I have.
Okay.
Let
me say, you know, first of all, beware of any sequel that comes 10 years after the first one.
Has it been 10 years?
It's been 10 years. I know it's not long enough. It's not exactly a milestone for the ages, but nevertheless, it's been 10 years. So, you know, the thing is, they used up most of the ABBA hits in the first one, so they kind of cherry-picked all the biggies. So there isn't a whole lot of, you know, it's mostly B-list, B-side ABBA stuff in this film. All right, that's a problem, you know. I mean, I will say I do like ABBA, okay? I've said it. I mean, I don't know if you can call what they do, you know, music, but earworms, you know, they're just...
They can write a hook.
They can really write a hook, okay. But they didn't write this movie, you know, and this it takes off on the first film. It cuts back and forth between 1979 with the free-loving Donna, you know, and then it moves to the present. It keeps cutting back and forth. Sophie, Donna's daughter, is now setting up the hotel in this beautiful, beautiful Greek island. For the arrival of many guests, including her three potential fathers. By the way, was it ever brought out that did anyone ever talk about a genetic testing for the three fathers? On the
no.
First
yeah.
No, and that's certainly come in the last 10 years.
That you know, would ruin would the think, fun.
I guess. Is it fun? Is that what it's going to ruin? The fun?
Bottom line is I think this is a really, you know, to put it charitably, diaphanous rendition of an idea that wasn't all that hot to begin with. I didn't find anyone in the cast to be of any great value. Cher, she comes on at the end, at the very end practically, wearing what looks like an albino fright wig.
Dear.
And you know, sings Fernando, you know, with great gusto.
Yeah, at least Cher can sing. As Peter says, part sequel, part prequel. We spend a lot of time in 1979.
Part something else.
Which
was 40 years ago.
With the young Donna. Interestingly, 10 years have not passed within the context of the film. It's only been a few years since, you know, the events of the previous film. And I'm not quite sure why they were cheating that. And look, here's the problem, actually, with this movie. Everybody knew that they were going to be making a sequel, right? It's a little thing called singing lessons and dancing lessons, folks. Take some singing lessons and take. Nobody can sing in this movie but Cher. I let you slide in the first movie. I did, Pierce. I let you slide. Okay? Stellan, I let you slide with that club-footed kind of thing. No. Learn how to dance. Learn how to sing. You're making a musical. This is not acceptable. There are people who can sing and dance, Broadway and other ways, who would love to get in this movie and knock all of this mediocre ABBA music out.
I really think about many of these musicals that are coming out. There are so many talented singers and dancers, but we're hiring Hollywood actors that's not their forte, which they then have to edit
in a million cuts to try and cover up the fact that they can't sing and dance.
You know what it goes back to? It goes back to Chicago. That's where it all started.
Which
with Rob Marshall,
Cheetah Rivera, and Gwen Verdon knocking people dead on stage.
But Renee Zellweger, I mean, come on, let's cut it out. Anyway,
Meryl Streep does show up in this film at the end. You know, even though she's technically passed away. Her character, and she can sort of sing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, she's proven it in other movies. It's what she has to sing that's also the problem.
So not your favorite so far. It's not enough to overcome and just kind of be a fun romp for you, Tim. What do you think? It's just a, you know, go and turn your brain off and hear some mediocre singing. Just not worth it.
I did that for Mamma Mia. I'm not doing it twice.
Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again stars Amanda Seyfried and Meryl Streep. Old Parker is the writer-director. It's rated PG-13, and it's in wide release. Okay, we're moving on. Next up is another sequel, The Equalizer 2, stars Denzel Washington and Pedro Pascal. Antoine Fuqua directs. Richard Wenk is the screenwriter, and it's based on the TV series created by Michael Sloan and Richard Lindham. Tim, what did you think?
Yeah, that TV series from the 1980s starred Edward Woodard. And I love that TV series from the 80s. It was really, really neat. I didn't care for the first Equalizer film because they really went away from that storyline, from what was going on in that series, and sort of, you know, walked a separate path. And that bugged me a little bit. Okay, so we come to The Equalizer 2. They're still walking their own path, but it's a better path. I like this movie a lot more. This movie is mostly about friendship, family, and even fatherhood in an odd sort of way. So we have Denzel Washington, who is Robert McCall, and he is this guy who is this machine and works undercover and does all of this stuff. And all he's really doing is mourning his dead wife. That's all he's really doing. And he lives in this building, and this skinny little black kid whose name I can't remember right now. Maybe somebody will look him up, who's kind of on the bubble there from of going bad or going good. He can paint, and he's smart, and he likes talking to Robert McCall. And he kind of takes him under his wing. Well, a terrible thing happens to a person. And Mr. McCall, the Equalizer, is going to have to get revenge for that. And then the movie goes into the mode that it's known for, Mr. McCall getting revenge and making people pay. I love the way he always explains to people why he's going to kill them, so that they're aware that, you know, I'm not just killing you. You know what you did. You did that thing, and now I got to kill you. And then he kills them all. That's kind of neat about this movie. And I do love the little father thing that's going on in this movie. It's kind of touching, a little bit moving. And that little kid, that boy, he can really, really act. I'm looking forward to seeing him again.
Peter, what did you think?
Yeah, I like the movie. I think the only problem I have with the Equalizer concept in both of these films is that Robert McCall never gets kidnapped. He never gets hurt. He never is threatened seriously. I mean, he basically just goes out there and decimates whoever is in his way.
Yeah, he's a machine.
In a righteous cause. But I have to say, I sort of get off on that. I mean, I like, you know, for once seeing a guy that just sort of goes through and does, you know, vengeance is mine and does it all. And you don't have to have all these stupid subplots about him getting, you know, having to fight his way out of something and getting kidnapped. He just does it. And, you know, so there's a certain visceral excitement in that. And it's very well directed. So, you know, I think this is apparently the first sequel that Denzel Washington has ever done.
Yeah, I heard that, too. And I went back to my little, and I'm like, wow, Denzel, look at you.
Yeah.
Whole career. Didn't repeat.
I wonder if that was a conscious decision on his part. Has he ever said anything about that? I mean, that's pretty interesting.
Mm. No, I mean, he's worked with the director before on, you know,
Training Day.
Got him
that Oscar.
And other, yeah. So I suppose my guess is that the director wanted to do it, and so he said, please come back and, you know, do a sequel and whatnot. So, but, you know, I think for what it is, it's very effective.
The Equalizer 2 from director Antoine Fuqua, who also directed the first Equalizer. It stars Denzel Washington and Pedro Pascal, and it's rated R in wide release. Blind Spotting, the comedic drama, comes to us from lifelong friends David Diggs and Rafael Casal, who co-wrote the screenplay and co-star in the film. Carlos Lopez Estrada makes his feature directorial debut. Tim, what did you think of Blind Spotting?
Well, this is just an extraordinary film for a whole lot of reasons. It's very, very funny, absolutely hysterically funny film, yet deeply moving and touching and a little bit tragic in all of the ways that we understand the world to be tragic today when it comes to young black men and guns and black communities and gentrification and so many things that are heavy in the zeitgeist today. This film speaks to them all, even though these young men wrote this film 10 years ago, right after Oscar Grant was killed at Fruitvale Station. And it took 10 years and getting a little bit famous for them to get it done. Interestingly, they could make it the same. They made the same movie they wrote 10 years ago. I've heard them say that. So we have this young man who's just gotten out of prison, and he's on his last 3 days of probation. He's got to finish his last 3 days of probation. He's staying in a sort of halfway house. He's just got to make it through these last 3 days. And, of course, in a film like this, these last 3 days are going to be the most taxing of his existence, mostly because of his very best friend, who he's known his whole life, a white dude with a brother complex, but a legitimate brother complex because the white dude grew up with all the brothers. And even that is a subject of the film, whether or not that is a legitimate thing, cultural appropriation, and whether or not that is a real thing. And the film is not a musical, but very often they're speaking in verse. Sometimes it's motivated because you're just joshing around. But there's a sequence of this film where he goes into verse that's not motivated in that way. And I got to tell you, I had a knot in my stomach for 3 minutes while this kid is doing this rap. And anything that makes you sweat like that is just damn good.
Yeah. Peter, what was your take?
I think it's intermittently powerful. I'm not quite as high on it as Tim. I do think, I mean, there are two sequences in it in this film that I think are indelible. You know, one is when Devine sees the shooting of an unarmed black man by a white cop and at a stop sign and you know, is frozen because he's on probation and feels he can't do anything about it. I mean, that is an incredibly galvanizing scene. And there's another one involving, you know, the baby daughter of the white kid who you know, suddenly is handling a gun and you know, the family is mortified by this and the ramifications of that. Two incredibly powerful scenes. What didn't work for me so much was that I think the film is so wildly ambitious that both of these guys, in various points in the movie as it develops, show an incredibly violent, vicious streak, which to me brings it out of what the film is attempting into something that seemed more sort of psychopathological, that you know, the violence that they demonstrate is so out of you know, out of the box that it knocked me out of the movie, you know, into something else that I felt wasn't really explored. But, you know, it certainly has its powerful moments and should be seen.
Blind Spotting stars David Diggs and Rafael Casal, who also co-wrote the screenplay, and Carlos Lopez Estrada makes his feature directorial debut. It is rated R, and you can see it at the Arclight Hollywood, AMC Century City, and the Landmark Theater in West L.A. For more on the film, you should check out the interview The Frame host John Horn did earlier this week with David Diggs and Rafael Casal. You can find that at kpcc.org/The Frame, and we will also post a link on our Film Week page. Up next, the British documentary McQueen, about the career and influence of British fashion visionary Alexander McQueen. Ian Bonholt makes his feature documentary debut. Charles, tell us about McQueen.
Well, there's been a whole spate of documentaries about fashion designers lately, which I seem to keep seeing. And my entire knowledge of fashion comes from Heidi Klum, and that one day you're in and the next day you're out. But this is a very interesting film. McQueen was certainly a key figure in recent fashion design couture. But he comes across in this film as just this bloke who turned out to have extraordinary talent. Even as a teenager, he's apprenticed to a Savile Row tailor and demonstrates that just by essentially looking at a piece of fabric, he knows where to cut it and where to sew it so that it will fit impeccably. And no matter how extravagant and even bizarre some of his designs were, they were flawlessly tailored so that they fit and became whomever put them on. I learned a lot about him from this film, although I am as non-fashionista as anyone can be.
As opposed to me.
Yes. I'm in cargo shorts and a Pixar Hawaiian shirt. Tim is turned out.
I can't help it.
That's why we're on radio and not TV.
Yes.
I grew up in the hood in the 70s. I can't help it. I'm wearing platform shoes, too. The thing about Mr. McQueen was that he was a bloke, this kid, right, from a very tough family. His father, he loved his mother deeply, deeply, deeply. He had a sister who he also loved very deeply. And when he finally made it, and made the world of haute couture, it all became about themes then.
And Tim, we're going to get back to this right after this very short break, because I want you to be able to launch all into it. Thanks for the pause here. Lots more to come here on Film Week, including a documentary called Love, Cecil, that examines the life and career of award-winning costume designer Cecil Beaton. We're on a design kick today on Film Week. I'm Libby Dankman, and this is Film Week on KPCC. You're You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KBCC. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle, and I'm joined by our critics Peter Rayner, Charles Solomon, and Tim Cogshell, who was right in the middle of a very eloquent analysis of McQueen, which is the feature directorial debut by Ian Bon Hote. So let us know, what did you think of McQueen?
Alexander McQueen, of course, being the haute couture designer, who in fact committed suicide not too terribly long ago.
Yeah, he was like 40.
He was 40 years old, committed suicide on the eve of his mother's funeral. And the thing about that, knowing that, that's a thing that's known, really informs you when you're watching this movie. And it makes you a little bit more sympathetic to his character, what was going on inside of his personal struggle. Once he became famous and he started doing those really big shows and they became thematic, a lot of those shows were truly, deeply hated when he first got started. He did one that involved women that looked sort of beat up and beat. You remember that one?
The Island Rape.
He wanted you to hate. Yeah. I mean, he was very happy with you
hating
what he did.
The show. And if you didn't understand what was going on, this was a boy who saw his mother beaten senseless by his father.
And was abused himself.
This was not a man who disliked women. This was a man who loved women and wanted them to appear strong. The women were beaten. Yes, but they were powerful and they were not put down. You had to understand the whole damn thing that was going on. And a lot of people, he resented the fact that a lot of people wouldn't go deep enough.
Peter? Yeah, the dichotomy between him being this sort of average-seeming bloke and the work that he did, I think, is fascinating. It's not altogether explored in this movie, perhaps, you know, necessarily. It's very hard to you know, come up with the kind of footage and commentary that would explain something like that. But I think it's a powerful film. Just a side question, I know nothing really about fashion to speak of, but so many of his creations, isn't the whole point of a fashion show to show off fashions that women will actually buy and wear?
Actually, no.
No, it's, I mean, if you're dressing Lady Gaga, what else matters?
Well, not haute couture shows. There are ready-to-wear shows that are exactly that. But haute couture shows are about something else. It's about artistry.
Pushing the boundaries.
So it's just, all right, because like 90% of what's on the runway in this film will never be worn by anybody except on the runway.
Well, even
it's
Lady
art,
Gaga.
Peter, it's art.
It's art,
even
okay.
Lady Gaga was the only person who could walk in that one pair of boots he designed for her.
Yeah.
Okay. That had, what, like 7-inch heels, I think?
Yeah, but that trickles down. You know, eventually a little piece of that will appear in a shoe store, you
know,
years from now.
Right, the haute couture stuff gets reduced to stuff that people can actually wear.
Okay. Yep. McQueen is a documentary from director Ian Bon Hote about British fashion designer Alexander McQueen. It's rated R, and you can see it at the Landmark Theater in West L.A. And coming up is next another documentary, Love, Cecil. It digs into the life and legacy of Academy Award-winning costume designer Cecil Beaton. He designed for award-winning films like My Fair Lady in 1964 with Audrey Hepburn and Rex Harrison. The film is directed by Lisa Imordino and, Vreeland. Lisa Imordino Vreeland. Peter, what did you think of Love, Cecil?
Yeah, the Vreeland part is her husband's grandfather. Grandmother. Diana Vreeland, yeah. Of Vogue fame, was her husband's grandmother. This is a very interesting movie because Cecil Beaton was such an interesting character. He wasn't just a set and costume designer or photographer. He was a writer. He was an artist. He was and a marvelous writer, too. He wrote many, many volumes of diaries, some of which I've dipped into that are quite insightful. He's known, I think, primarily in this country for the work that he did on My Fair Lady as a set and costume designer.
That hat.
The Ascot Gavotte.
Right. Sure. And also, he worked on Gigi and On a Clear Day You Can See Forever and other films. His photography was quite extraordinary and captured particularly celebrities in a way that they'd never been captured quite, as insightfully. He said that he always photographed them to be like what you would imagine them to be as opposed to who they were, he was essentially gay, but he apparently had some sort of relationship, quasi-romantic, with Greta Garbo for many years.
He was also a little gay.
A little gay, right.
Yes.
So,
interesting.
All of that is,
there are a lot of talking heads in the movie, lots of archive photos, lots of, you know, bitchy comments by the likes of Truman Capote and others about him. He was not a well-liked guy.
Juicy stuff.
But I think it covers so much of the history of fashion, of photography, of Hollywood for decades through the lens of this guy that it's really almost kind of a fun history lesson.
But
Tim, what did I you think, oh, excuse me, Charles, go
I,
ahead.
I think it's also kind of a long history lesson and a repetitious one. How many times do we get the screen split into three with three photographs of the same photograph three times? And clearly the filmmaker doesn't know how to end it, because there are a whole series of quotes from him, quotes from other people, shots of his old house. It's like a fish flopping. It just won't die.
And Cecil, and I love that we keep saying Cecil,
yes,
as opposed to Cecil. And Cecil is in the film, archive footage of him talking in interviews. And they were fairly candid interviews where he said things. He said, and when they would ask him, would you like to talk about such and such? He'd say, yeah, sure, let's talk about it.
Bring it on.
And he would say, he would offer his thoughts. And that was the nature of him. Lots of folks did not like him.
And vice versa.
You know, and
some very nice things to say about Noel Coward and Yvon Lenoir, not.
But then Noel Coward had made fun of him in his Bright Young People song.
Yeah,
quite specifically.
That's
and his whole
the way
crowd.
Things were in those days. He was also a wonderful photographer during World War II,
which
not people know, about. He did a lot of you know, photographs of, you know, death and destruction and so forth that really resonate. It's a little bit like Avedon, you know, sort of having this bifurcated career of you know, sort of stark, non-fashion kind of celebrity stuff, and then, you know, what he was more known for.
Although he had this way of sexualizing all of those soldiers. And you look at those photographs, they look Avedon.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, these soldiers with no shirts and all, and it's all very, very sexualized, but only he was doing it, and that's what makes it unique.
Yeah.
Love, Cecil is the documentary from director Lisa Immordino Vreeland about acclaimed costume designer Cecil Beaton, or Cecil Beaton, whatever you want to say. It's unrated and playing at the New Art Theater in West LA. Up next, the horror movie Unfriended: Dark Web, from writer-director Stephen Susko, who also wrote the Grudge movies. He makes his feature directorial debut here. The movie is a sequel to the 2014 movie Unfriended, making it our third sequel this week. We're tallying them up. It stars Colin Waddell, Rebecca Rittenhouse, Chelsea Alden, and Andrew Lees. So, Peter, what did you think?
Well, let me just say, you know, not being a techie to begin with, and also finding it incredibly annoying when I'm watching a movie and there are people all around me who are on their phones and laptops and
in
MacBooks.
In the theater, cringe.
And critics' screenings included, I might add.
Oh, no.
Seeing an entire movie that is basically a projection of a MacBook screen, it was not my idea of a fun time. For what it is, it's very effective and scary. The entire film is a kind of worst-case scenario paranoia trip about, you know, what happens when, you know, you eventually, you know, you steal a computer and then the owner comes after you, and is this whole malicious netherworld of the web that these kids plug into, and then it sort of turns into a, you know, and then there were none scenario, cyber style. I like these kind of movies to be a little more fun than they are on some level, you know. I mean, this movie is just incredibly, you know, dark and sadistic.
Unrelenting.
Unrelentingly sadistic. And I don't know, if you're going to do a movie like that, it better be about the Holocaust or something and not, you know, about somebody stealing a MacBook.
Yeah, you need a little bit of a sense of humor. Unfriended: Dark Web is written and directed by Stephen Susko. The film is rated R and it's in wide release. Makia, When the Promised Flower Blooms. It's a Japanese animated film written and directed by Mari Okada, who makes her feature directorial debut. Charles, what did you think?
Well, this is one of the things that makes this interesting is that Okada is a very popular, very prolific screenwriter for animation in Japan. This is her beginning as a director. There are very few women directors in Japan. There are some producers. There are very successful manga artists and writers, but this is, you know, one of a rare occasion of a woman breaking into the direction. And the film is a sort of maternal romance, but it's very heavily steeped in the Japanese belief that all beauty is fleeting. And that's what in fact makes it beautiful. that the idea of something is eternally beautiful really doesn't they don't believe in. The title character is a member of a race who are something close to immortal, but they stop aging when they're teenagers. So she remains young and beautiful throughout it. But when she's taken from her land to a part of the human world, she adopts a baby that's whose parents have been killed in battle. And she has to care for him, although she admits she knows nothing about being a mother. He ages and eventually dies. She has to witness all of this, but is unwavering in her love for him. She cares as much for him as a baby as when he's an enfeebled old man. It's a little long. It has a few too many endings, but it's a very interesting film and very, very different from anything that we would do in this country.
Mm. Makio, When the Promised Flower Blooms, an animated film from the prolific writer Mari Okada. It's unrated, and you can see it at the Regal LA Live in downtown LA, Starlight, Whittier Village, Harkins Cerritos, and Harkins Chino Hills, the Starlight Cinema City in Anaheim, and the Starlight Dos Lagos in Corona. Up next, the British documentary Path of Blood. It's a jarring look at the recruitment, training, and ideological tactics of Al-Qaeda using recovered home movies shot by the organization itself. Jonathan Hacker makes his debut directing a documentary feature. Tim, what did you think?
Well, let me say this about it. It's the kind of movie that you, if you watch it, there will be things that you will never be able to get out of your head that you may not want to put in your head. I'm one of those people. I don't care for horrible images. The world is bad enough, you know, and so warning right there, right now. These young men are going about taping themselves, doing everything that they do, going on their missions and in between. The striking thing about this movie is that other than the fact that they are zealots, generally speaking, there are these perfectly ordinary, goofy, silly boys. It's silly in every way that you could think of any teenager or young 20-year-old or whatever possibly being. And then they talk about the fact that they are going to go to Allah. And then they go out and commit these horrible, horrible acts of violence and terrorism. One of the big attacks in here is on a Saudi. Most of this happens in Saudi Arabia. It's on a Saudi, what was it, an oil field or something like that? And we can mostly hear them. This one is particularly chilling because the camera is at an awkward angle pointing at the floor or the sky or whatever it is. And we can mostly simply hear them. And when you hear this young man talking about, I'm going to get out, I'm going to go shoot him in his head. I'm going to get out and shoot him in his head, and then you ram the thing. You got it? Okay. And then he opens the door and he gets out and he goes and does it. As if he went, difficult.
And then he gets shot in
the head. Yeah.
Well, is that what makes it so horrifying, that these do seem to be otherwise normal kids?
Yeah,
the thing is, it's that's what's so shocking about this movie, aside from, you know, the imagery and all, is this, you know, amazing footage that they have of these Al-Qaeda kids who are, you know, speaking into the camera, who are, in some cases, we see them, you know, torturing captive Americans.
And how did he achieve
Americans.
This, the home movies? How did he get
they
them?
They obviously filmed them themselves, and then they were recovered by the Saudi police when they raided these cells. So there were, you know, bins and bins of this stuff. And, you know, you have to sort of, I had to keep reminding myself that this was real and not, you know, acted. Because it seems so inside to be able to see this stuff.
Yeah, we're going to be right back, guys, with a couple more reviews. This is Film Week on 89.3 KBCC. I'm Libby Denkman, sitting in for Larry Mantle. We'll also have a conversation about Eighth Grade, the coming-of-age comedy that has a rating that doesn't let a lot of its primary audience go see it without parental consent, coming up after this break. It's Film Week on 89.3 KBCC. I'm Libby Denkman, in for Larry Mantle today, and I'm joined by our critics, Peter Rayner, Charles Solomon, and Tim Cogshell. Very glad to have you with us, whether you're listening to the live broadcast on Friday at 11, the Saturday broadcast at noon, or on the Film Week podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. Coming up, we are going to talk about the coming-of-age film Eighth Grade and the MPAA rating that keeps some teenagers that are the same age as the protagonist from seeing the film in theaters. We'll discuss with our critics and a member of the MPAA. coming up in just a few minutes. We're going to get some more reviews here, though. First, the documentary King Cohen, The Wild World of Filmmaker Larry Cohen, from writer-director Steve Mitchell, who makes his debut directing a documentary feature. It features interviews with Cohen himself, as well as J.J. Abrams, Robert Forster, Martin Scorsese, and others. The title lays out the premise of the movie pretty well, so let's just dive right in, guys. Tim, for those who might not know him, who is Larry Cohen?
Larry Cohen is a director whose movies, at least some of his movies, I promise you, you love. And everyone listening has seen a Larry Cohen movie, whether you know you've seen it or not, you have. And Larry Cohen is all over this film, by the way. He's in the film walking and talking. He's down at Comic-Con. He's 80-something years old. He's a raconteur. And the thing about Larry Cohen is Black Caesar, Q, Stuff, It's Alive, Maniac Cop, and newer films like Phone Booth and Cellular. Larry Cohen has Maniac Cop 2 in pre-production right now.
Of course.
He's Larry Cohen. Now,
Private Files of J. Edgar Hoover.
With Roderick Crawford, right, and all that kind of stuff. the thing about Larry, this movie reminded me of why I actually love movies. It's really because of the movies that guys like Larry and Roger Corman made. They're the reason why I actually love movies as a child. The movies you come to as a child, they brought me to movies, and then I learned to like better movies. But nevertheless, these guys are a solid foundation of that. The thing about Larry is he's actually a much better filmmaker than he's given credit for. Larry had the talent of John Cassavetes as a filmmaker. He really did. He happened to make a different kind of films like Q and It's Alive and Maniac Cop.
And that's kind of like cult classic stuff.
Yeah,
Not movies.
I can see from your eyes. You have no idea what I'm talking about.
There's a vacant look behind my expression right now.
I can promise you that these are all fantastic films. And even if you haven't seen them, you've seen the ones that grew out of them, that other filmmakers, when they made their films, they're just biting Larry, and Larry made created six television series before the 60s ended. Branded, Coronet Blue, The Invaders. Before the 60s was over, he had already established the zeitgeist of what television would be for the next 40 years.
So super influential for folks like J.J. Abrams, who appears in the movie. It just ripples out his impact.
And Martin Scorsese, also in the film, talking about Larry, because Martin Scorsese is a scholar and a historian of cinema. The way he talks about Larry Cohen, you know that Taxi Driver has Larry all over it.
King Cohen, The Wild World of Filmmaker Larry Cohen, written and directed by Steve Mitchell, unrated, and you can see it at Lemley's, Aria Fine Arts Theater in Beverly Hills. Finally, Generation Wealth, a documentary written and directed by Laura Greenfield. It explores wealth culture around the world and looks at the societal factors behind it. Peter, what did you think?
Well, your description of the movie is what I wish the film had been. This is one of these documentaries that kind of has a certain thesis that then, completely disperses and becomes all sorts of other things that don't necessarily coalesce. Lauren Greenfield went back and spoke to quite a few of the younger people that she's had met years ago in her other films, and to see where they are now in terms of having grown up, wealthy and spoiled. And predictably, many of them are not terribly happy, not terribly wealthy, and some have gone in for terrible amounts of plastic surgery and whatnot. But she also, the director interviews her mother about her own upbringing, and then Chris Hedges keeps chiming in about how we're basically at Armageddon with this, whole, wealth out of control apocalypse. And I don't know, it's way too ambitious, I think, for what it actually is.
I agree with Peter completely. It's spread all over the place. For one thing, she seems to be questioning how the wealth was obtained. A lot of the time, and how it's being spent. We spend a whole lot of time in strip clubs with strippers. We spend in basketball players and ballers and hip hop stars. But we don't spend any time with Jeff Bezos or Mr. Gates or anybody named Trump
or their children.
We don't seem to be concerned with how they got all their money and what they're doing with their money. I don't know. There's something disparate about that. I like her. She made a wonderful movie called The Queen of Versailles a couple of years ago. Finn is an astounding movie.
Sure.
Those characters are in this film.
In this film for Finn. But this doesn't be about – and she's making – or I felt like judgments were being made about these people. I felt like she was making judgments about these strippers.
And it doesn't quite coalesce around a thesis, as Peter was saying.
Yeah.
Generation Wealth is the documentary from writer-director Laura Greenfield, rated R for strong sexual content, nudity, disturbing images, and drug material. You can see it at the Arclight Hollywood. Speaking of ratings, Bo Burnham's new coming-of-age comedy, Eighth Grade, stars Elsie Fisher. It's an honest account of being a 13-year-old, all the lovely, weird, excruciating moments that go along with that, especially in the digital age. But there's a disconnect between content and customers at the box office for this film. Actual 13-year-olds can't go see the movie without a parent's permission. That's because 8th grade is rated R by the Motion Picture Association of America. We want to talk about what it takes for a movie to get an R rating and how that may restrict young viewers from content that's uniquely important for them. And we want to hear from you. Give us a call at 866-893-5722. What did you think of the MPAA's rating system when it comes to teen movies? What do you think of that? And parents, do you follow the rating system when you decide what movies your kid can or can't watch? 866-893-5722. Right now on the line with me, in addition to our critics in the studio, is Joan Graves, a senior vice president and chair of the Classification and Rating Administration. That's CARA for the Motion Picture Association of America. Welcome, Joan, to Air Talk. Thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity when there are questions to be able to clarify.
Yes. So also in the studio, I just want to reset Tim Cogshell, film critic for KPCC and the Alt Film Guide, and Synagogues, Peter Rayner, film critic for KPCC and Christian Science Monitor, and Charles Solomon, critic for KPCC, and of course, Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. Joan, I'll start with you. Can you explain how the rating system works? Why does a movie like 8th grade get an R rating?
Well, we are lucky enough in our explanation of each rated film to give a descriptor, and it was rated R, I believe, for some language and sexual material. And our purpose is to give parents a snapshot view of the level of content in a film so they can make choices for their own children and take them where they feel appropriate, or arrange for them to see it if they think it's appropriate. In this particular case, it was fairly standard given the content of the film. There were over 8 uses of the F word and some discussions of sexual acts and sexual toys, which are fairly standard R-rated material and are not included in PG-13.
And just to be clear, in terms of the process, do you have a panel that watches and determines this, or what's the actual step-by-step to give the rating?
Parents, and when they're hired to be on the board, they have children between the ages of 5 and 15, so they're actively involved in the process themselves. Their purpose is to reflect standards, not set them. And there's not one of our ratings that indicates a film is good or bad. It goes right to the level of content so that the parents then can make their own choices.
Okay. On the line with me is Joan Graves, Senior Vice President and Chair of the Classification and Rating Administration for the Motion Picture Association of America. We're talking about teen movies like 8th grade and a rating system. I'm interested, Joan, we are up against a break here, but we'll be back with more discussion. Why do you think there was a backlash against the rating for 8th grade? Have you seen that kind of backlash before?
Well, I'm not so sure I would say there's a backlash, actually. I have seen it before, and it's, in my view, mostly coming from people that don't understand our system and don't understand that it's primarily for parents to give them information so they can make choices. I myself am a parent of 2 girls, and I did take them to some R-rated material, and we had wonderful discussions about the film. And I learned how they thought about things, and they certainly learned how I thought about things. It was a wonderful experience. So this does not exclude kids from seeing the film. It just gives the parents a heads up as to there's certain content in the film that's considered more adult.
Sure. Joan Graves with the MPAA. We'll be back with more discussion of 8th grade, teen movies, and R ratings and how they can restrict the audience for a movie that's really made for teens. Back more with our critics on Film Week after this short break. It's Film Week from 89.3 KBCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle today. We're talking about 8th grade, the coming-of-age comedy from writer-director Bo Burnham. It's raised some eyebrows because of an R rating that has had a chilling effect on actual 8th graders going to see the movie because they have to get parental permission in theaters. We're discussing the issue of ratings of teen movies and whether that is appropriate for content that's really aimed at at young teenagers. And we have on the line Joan Graves with the MPAA to share her perspective. Also in studio, our Film Week critics. And Charles Solomon, what did you want to say about the issue of ratings and teen movies like this?
Well, I have a question for our guest, which is, you said that all of the people who rate the films have children between 5 and 15. Are any of those people psychologists, psychiatrists, or therapists?
Joan Graves on the line from the MPAA. Who is this population of folks who rate it?
No, they are not. And that is an intentional part of it set out by Jack Valenti in 1968. He wanted a cross-section of parents across the country to be on the rating board and not be not have academic training or medical training, just to be parents giving information to parents. So it's on purpose that we don't have experts. Frequently, experts do not agree either. And also, keep in mind that this is a snapshot view of content, and we encourage always parents to look other places if they need more details about a film so that they can really, really craft it for their own families.
Tim Cogshill, I want to pull you into the conversation because I was reading up on some other teen movies that had gotten R ratings in the past. Boyhood by Richard Linklater was one of them, which I thought was one of the sweetest, most thoughtful coming-of-age movies I've seen in quite some time. But for teenagers who are actually going through a period like that in their lives, it's off limits unless they're 17. Mm. What are some of the movies maybe that you feel like have not received correct ratings? Or is there anything you want to say about the rating system and how teens may be limited in seeing these movies?
Well, yeah, let me go to that, to the whole notion, if I might, of the rating system. The problem with the rating system isn't the aggregation of content, telling parents what's in a movie. There is nudity, there is smoking, there is foul language, or whatever it is. I have no problem with that whatsoever. I have a problem with that actual rating, PG-13, 13, X, R, 7, all of that. That's what I have a problem with, because then you're making a decision about what that information means, what that content means. And that I don't think we need to be doing for parents or anybody else. I'm okay with any system that says this is the actual information, this is what happens in this movie. After that, it's up to parents to decide what they want their children to see or not. Children are not the same. I used to be an old high school teacher. I can tell you any two seventh graders sitting next to each other is different as night and day in their sophistication and their understanding of things. And those two seventh graders' parents can figure out what movie they need to go see.
Joan Graves, what do you think about that concept that, you know, different teenagers are at different points in their lives and giving parents information is good, but
totally
limiting is...
Nobody
sure.
knows their children better than parents, and I know that children within a family are very different too, and according to their fears and their weaknesses and sensibilities, and parents know that. And I think that when you term an R off limits, that is not how we view an R. We view an R as giving parents information about a certain level of content there, and then they make the decision. Children can certainly go to R-rated movies with their parents or when it's approved for them to see it with their parents.
I don't know. Your description of...
Peter Rayner, yep.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think, you know...
Oh, I'm sorry. That's Charles. Oh. My bad. Yeah, Charles, go ahead.
That description of eighth grade sounded like my eighth grade locker room, and nobody had to approve my going to that.
You know, I think when the rating system was started, I think it had utility because it at least kept the states from creating their own censorship boards.
Yeah.
It you know, the Legion of Decency and all of these organizations that were, you know, making it so difficult to have cutting-edge content in films went away. And it was partly responsible for the renaissance, I think, in films that occurred in Hollywood in the late 60s and 70s. But I think now we're in a different kind of culture. And, you know, having seen eighth grade, And echoing what my colleagues have said about, you know, this being something that is certainly not unusual in any eighth grade class that any student would, the culture has changed, and I know that Joan is saying that they don't set standards, they just reflect them, but it's more complicated than that.
Mm.
You know, movies reflect a lot of what's going on in society. They also create trends, and if you prohibit or make it difficult for the very kids who might be benefited by this film to see it, then I think it's much more of a disservice than a service, not only to them, but to their parents.
I do have an actual seventh grader on the line with me right now, Garrett in Chatsworth. What do you think about the rating system and what it means for what movies you can see?
Hey, man. So here's the thing. I'm in 10th grade, actually, and I go to school out here in the Valley, and I've seen R-rated movies before. You know, it's not really a big deal for me at this point. And my parents know that. The people, my friends know that. They also are allowed to see these kinds of movies. And it's cool, you know. And the thing about 8th grade is I've been in 8th grade before. You know, it was 2 years ago for me. And it's not really, you know, if you're going to be censoring, you can't censor school, you know. And you can't censor what the other kids are going to be doing. So when you're taking the movie and putting it on the big screen for everyone to see, the kids who it's about, I think that they should be able to see it.
Yeah.
That's them up there.
Garrett in Chatsworth, sorry to get your grade wrong. That's on our bad, but adding a couple of grades there, a 10th grader weighing in. Joan, I'm going to give you the last word. What do you think about Garrett's words?
Well, he is an example of someone who has seen R-rated movies, and I'm assuming his parents, from what he said, know it and approve of it, and that's the way the system is meant to work, actually.
But it sounds like he's saying that because, you know, plenty of 15-, 16-year-olds can go to the mall on their own, but they can't go choose to see an R-rated movie on their own. But if it's content targeted to them, you know, and it reflects what they're seeing in everyday life, why shouldn't they be able to see it?
Well, you know, we do a lot of follow-up with parents. We have surveys every other year about the different factors, how they're feeling about sexuality, language, drug use, and how they see it in terms of being rated. And we do opinion research surveys every year to find out if parents are happy with our system, think we're giving them useful information. And our surveys are revealing that parents feel very strongly about the different factors, and sex and language are two of the things they care most about for younger children. I'm not talking about throughout life. I'm talking about when they're raising children. They care very strongly about those two issues. They think their children pick up a lot, perhaps that they shouldn't, if they're exposed to them at a time where they're not able to filter.
And it's well taken, Joan. I'm so sorry we're up against the end of the show, but Joan Graves with the MPAA, thank you very much for joining the conversation, as well as Tim Cogshell, Peter Rayner, and Charles Solomon, our critics here on Film Week. This is Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle, reminding you that you can hear Film Week every Friday live at 11, Saturday at noon, and anytime at all via the Film Week podcast, available where you listen. I'll be back hosting next week. Thank you so much for listening to Air Talk.